welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. Kay Murray and Shaka Hislop with you in the studio. And then joining us, we have Nedim Anua, Craig Burley and Ian Dark as well. And we'll be looking ahead to a big game coming up this weekend in the Premier League. It is the Manchester Derby. It is first against second, as you can see at the top of the table. Mind, there's 14 points between them. It's a lead that looks unassailable given the form that City are in. But Nedim, any reason to think that your old team can't beat United?
No, well, I like the way you frame the question. Of course they can beat United, but the fact of the matter is it's the Manchester Derby. I think if we only look back to last season, I think United beat City three times. So they need to have that level of confidence going into the game if they still have a chance, because otherwise, if you, as I think as they say about the Yankees, if you get lost just looking at the pinstripes, then ultimately I think it'll be a long day for you.
Ian, we're coming up against a team with obviously a great winning run and a team with a brilliant away streak. So how do you see this one playing out?
Well, I think there's no logical way to tip against Manchester City the way they're playing. They're like a machine at the moment. Stones and Diaz at the back are playing well. They're impregnable when those two are together. Stones was rested in midweek. He'll be back. Gundogan will be back in midweek. But, you know, it was a 0-0 draw earlier in the season, and it was about as interesting as watching, you know, listening to the shipping forecast. It was that bad a game. So the first thing is, let's hope this is a better game. United have drawn their last three games 0-0. So I think it'll be a bit less of a chess match this time. I think United might go for it a little bit more with the gap at 14 points. At least I hope they will. But I could see United maybe getting a draw, possibly, out of the game.
Well, Craig, when United have got the problems that they have scoring, it's not going to get any easier against this City defence.
No, and you've only got to look at the record recently against the big teams, and it's appalling. And so there's nothing to suggest in their recent form that that's going to change. But as Nedim said, look, they have had success against City. They do play a counter-attacking style, but even that counter-attacking style hasn't really been working for them as well of late. And you're not going to challenge for the Premier League title if you can't get the job done against the other big boys. And that's been a problem for them. Look, we talk about the nil, they talk about the game early in the season, and we talk about the chess match. That was a chess match because Manchester City were in a much more vulnerable position at that time, both defensively and in their league position. That's not the case anymore. You know, even if by some, you know, strange turn, United were to find some form and win this game, City are still going to win the league. I mean, they're going to have to lose four or five games. That's almost 50% of their games left to lose this league. And the rest are going to have to win all the way through, or United will. That's not going to happen. So we're not going to see a cautious City like we saw earlier in the season, because they're in a much better position. And so they'll go out and they'll try and put the hammer down, I'd imagine.
Yeah, obviously, as mentioned, there were those previous meetings, that 0-0 that we did see. But this is in all competitions and what we're seeing. In the Premier League alone, though, United have won two of the previous three. They drew that one that we just did mention. How do you think it's going to play out, Shaka?
Look, I'm with you boys here, and I think this quite clearly is City's to lose. I'm trying to find a way, other than giving Manchester United a puncher's chance, as to how they get the better of Manchester City. And in all honesty, given what you saw, even in that dour 0-0 that you saw back in December, I think it was, I think what you saw from City is their approach, not just against United, but going forward, that they were prepared to sit deep and take the counter-attacking threat that Manchester United had. What you saw in the following game in the Cup is a front three that sat in between United's midfield and defence, and were just kind of relentless in how they attacked Manchester United. And they were by far the better of the two, and some will point to the two goals coming from set pieces. But it's a game that Manchester City, for me, dominated, deservedly won. Took away Manchester United's counter-attacking threat, and as a result, nullified them for the most part. That's how you see things playing out again this time.
I was just going to say, look, we can look at graphics and we can look at, you know, score lines, and we can look at the zero goal for Man United, but that doesn't tell the story. The story is, not only have the results recently not been good enough, but the football's not been very slick or impressive either. So you have a double barrel problem here. Is one, you haven't been scoring, and two, you haven't been playing particularly good football and looking as attacking as you were maybe, say, in November and December. Contrast that to Manchester City. And no matter who comes in the side, there's a plan. And there's a plan about the way they do it. And there's a rotation in the midfield to front. There is a threat from the middle of the park. And this has all really been done for pretty much most of the season without a natural striker. So let's be quite frank about this. Manchester City, and it's possible, Manchester City will have to have a bad day at the office if they're going to lose this game.
Is that good enough, though, Nedim, that it has to be a bad day at the office for City when you're a team the size of United?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But then, as I say, this is a game's a bit different because of the fact it's a derby. But to jump on the back of something you said, Craig, it's interesting because I think attacking-wise, maybe they did look better in October, November, December time for United. But when we look at the teams that they put out, I wouldn't say Solskjaer's going with a defensive lineup. So I'd like to know what you think has changed, because I think with Ole himself, I think he actually said in some of those big games, like against Chelsea, although it was a bad game, United did try and have a high press. Do you think they're better off as a team who just drop off and try and hit on the counter-attack because they don't have anything in terms of just an attacking threat in general play? Or do you think they should carry on doing what they're doing and trying to press high?
I think one of the things is that that they had a successful counter-attacking option for a while, but they didn't have a plan B. And that was a problem for them, particularly against, at that point, some of the so-called smaller teams who sat in. And they at one point looked more threatening against the bigger teams because they didn't bother about possession as much. And then they used the pace of Martial and Rashford and the likes in behind. I think that threat is somewhat gone. And they don't have a slick rotational forward movement in transition like Manchester City. It's just, and Liverpool have got that issue as well a little bit at the moment, is where we're not seeing, and the reason for theirs, I think, is more personnel, because we know about their injury problems and some players have lost form. But they're not transitioning like the team they once were either, and that's been a problem for them. I think United have lost a bit of that spark as well going forward. They haven't dominated teams. They haven't passed it as well. I think Bruno Fernandes has been snuffed out a little bit more recently. And when that's happened and they've had to look to go somewhere else, they haven't had another great option. Even though they'll say, well, we've got some attacking players here, we've got him to come in, we've got Cavani to come back in, got Van de Beek on the bench, doesn't get used much. You look at Guardiola, when he rotates, you know, Gundogan was out with a small injury for a while, someone else comes in and fills that role, fills that goal-scoring void. Foden goes in the team, he comes out the team. De Bruyne is out for a few weeks. They bring people in, they rotate, but they generally get the same performance. I think for United, it's crystal clear. If they're not getting the ball into Fernandes, if Rashford's off form at all, it's not happening for them.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer,
that's a key thing, I think. Yeah. That's a key thing, Craig. Bruno Fernandes, you said he's been snuffed out of a couple of games lately. I think he's tired. He's played a lot of games. Mm. They rely on him a lot. And he's vital in this game. They need him to come back to life. Of course, City will have their plans for him. But if he's working his magic, to use a tired old word, but if he is, Manchester United could be in business in this game, I think.
Do you know the other thing I haven't liked about Fernandes, apart from his performances, the other thing I haven't liked about Fernandes from about 4 to 6 weeks ago, and we touched on it on the show, was clearly, as a player with his talent, he's now a marked man in the Premier League. You know, welcome to the playmakers in the Premier League. You're marked out every week. And the one thing that I noticed with him, and we discussed it, was a couple of times, I can't remember the players, but they put kind of heavy challenges in on him early in games. And he was complaining to the referee straight away. He didn't like it. And I think in some sense, he's starting to get put off his game a little bit more by people coming in and, you know, leaving a couple of late challenges on him. Not enough to get red cards or bookings, but enough to annoy him. And I think in some sense, his mind's been turned by that. And I think they're really great players, particularly in the Premier League in England over the years. They've dealt with that the best. They've accepted that they're going to be targeted by guys who want to stop them. And they've generally got on with it. I noticed a few weeks ago, Bruno Fernandes was starting to complain. And I think that's had an adverse effect on his performances.
So, Craig, if you stop Fernandes, do you stop United?
Well, it's not as simple as that, Kay, but it certainly nullifies a huge threat from them because his passing range is so good. And his eye for an early pass is so good. But I personally don't, and maybe Nedim and the other guys at No City will have an opinion on this. I don't think Guardiola will be overly concerned about, I mean, he'll be thinking about him, but I think City will want to, they know they've got Rodri or Fernandinho, whoever it is, can come in and do a great job. But I think they'll be trying to put on United what City are all about. And if United don't have the ball particularly much in the game, there's not a great deal Bruno Fernandes can do.
Do you agree with that, Nedim?
Yes and no. I think recently I've heard Pep say a lot that they focus on one game at a time. And one thing in which they do there, they see what the opposition's strengths are and they try and stop them. And I think in recent games, when you've seen them play against Wolves, when you see them play against Spurs, with the Spurs counter-attack and the Wolves counter-attack, they spent a lot of time swarming the ball play, whoever had the ball whenever there was a quick turnover. And it made it very difficult for them to sort of start really good sort of progressive attacks. And that isn't necessarily something that they did in previous, in other games, essentially, because the strength might exist elsewhere. And I think with Manchester United, if Fernandes is the main playmaker and United maybe refuse to go through anybody else but him, then I think Pep will notice that and you might see a tactical change going into the weekend. But then I also think he's very aware of other potential match winners for United. But at the moment, you are looking at Fernandes and maybe he doesn't like being kicked and so on. But then in the same breath, he could also be disappointed because as far as pulling weight goes, you know, he's been the main man for United this season. I think Rashford has chipped in with quite a few goals. But then after that, you're looking around and you're wondering, you know, what more can he do in this instance? And, you know, for me, being someone who's essentially blue, the more frustrated he is, I think the better it is for City. So long may that continue.
Shaka, Ole says he doesn't buy the out-of-form narrative for his side. Whose fault is it that at second place they're 14 points behind the leaders? Is it his or is it his team's?
Well, it's a share of these spoils. Listen, Manchester City are just so much better than everybody else. You accept that lead for what it is, and United were playing catch-up on everybody else. They seem to have done that only City in their sights now. So you take that for what it is. But on the one hand, you have Ole talking about or criticising the critique of them being low in form and low in confidence, given the last three nil-nils, which, if you're sitting in that dressing room or you're a Manchester United supporter, you look at those three and say, well, okay, we had already beat Sociedad 4-0 in the first leg, so no harm done there in just shutting up shop. You play out a 0-0 against Chelsea. You've only conceded two since Tommy Tuchel took over. And the one real disappointment is Crystal Palace, which was an awful game, in all honesty. But if you look further back than that, ever since United beat Liverpool, they've only beat Southampton 9-0, which you mentioned, Sociedad, Newcastle 3-1, and they beat West Ham in the cup after extra time. That's not good enough for a Manchester United team who needs to maintain that kind of form if they are to stay second in the table. They're not going to catch City, but they have to at least stave off the challenges of those coming behind. And right now, United have a lot of issues, regardless of how Ole tries to spin this to his dressing room.
But Craig, Edward Wood said this week that the progress is clear under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Well, he quite frankly, he hasn't got a clue about what's happening on the football field. Let's be straight about that. Look, all of a sudden, the rhetoric from Old Trafford and some of the protagonists is seconds good. You know, two or three months ago, it was top of the league, and this is great, and Fernandes, and we're doing this, and this manager's great. Now, all of a sudden, it's changed as well. You know, but nobody was expecting this. I mean, what utter nonsense. I mean, Manchester United, having spent what they've spent, and Solskjaer been in there for the time being, he's been in there, with City starting the season the way they started and playing without a striker, second is not good enough for Man United. I mean, let's be frank about it. They're pretty much only second because Liverpool's season has imploded for obvious reasons through personnel. Chelsea sacked their manager, and let alone Leicester City are up there with a lot of injuries. So I can't get my head around this, second's okay, while your neighbours across the city are streaking away 14 points. My views on this have not changed for 2 years. Yes, there needs to be some personnel changes. Of course, there does. But I think there has to be coaching changes as well at Manchester United. And I think whilst they keep the current regime, there'll always be an afterthought to Liverpool and Man City and maybe even Chelsea when Tuchel gets his feet under the carpet. And that's a decision that they have to make. But if Ed Woodward's saying there's progress, he's watching something different to what I'm watching.
And you wonder, Ian, just how defining March could be for Manchester United. These are their upcoming fixtures. Obviously, the big one at the weekend. Then they've got those two games against Milan in the Europa League. They've got West Ham coming up and Leicester City as well. That's not an easy run. And it definitely could ask some questions of Solskjaer, surely.
Well, absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, to be fair to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and to come back at Craig, earlier on in the season, I remember being on this programme and everybody was laughing at the idea that Manchester United would get back into the top four. Well, they're in second place at the moment and nobody's going to catch Manchester City because nobody's in the same class as them. So they've gone 20-something games unbeaten away from home. So they're doing something right, Craig. They're not as awful, I think, as you're making out. I think they held Manchester City to a goalless draw once. Yeah, they're out the Champions League. They win a tough group. The Europa League, big for them. But I still think in this game against Manchester City, you say they're not scoring goals and they're upset about not scoring goals and they've looked a bit punchless lately. But they have kept three clean sheets in a row too. And a lot of people said to you, well, when they played Real Sociedad, oh, that's a difficult tie. They could go out there. They thumped them 4-0 away. So they're not awful, I don't think, Manchester United. Yeah, they're not what they used to be under Alex Ferguson, but that, you know, 8-9 years ago now.
Yeah, but do you just accept that? Whilst Liverpool have a struggling coach this year, but a great coach, while City have a great coach and a great side and are not going away, do you just accept that you have a manager who has got no real track record at this level of getting the job done? And by the way, you're painting everybody with that same brush, Darkie, because I think I had United in the top four at the start of the season, but I certainly didn't have them winning the league. And I go back to the point, you know, at what point is finishing second and third good enough for this? And how many years does that last for? Because Mourinho had them in winning the League Cup, winning the Europa League, second in the league with 81 points. They've been there recently with another manager. How many years does it last? Just saying, well, you know, City are a good side and we've done what we can, but do you know what? Second or third is going to be acceptable for us. We're talking about Manchester United here, for God's sake.
So that's where they are, Craig, isn't it? Now, that's where they are. That's where everybody, except Manchester City and Liverpool, have been for the last few years. The best they can do is finish second, and they're second at the moment.
I think you'll find Chelsea won the league in recent years under Antonio Conte. I think you'll find Leicester City in 2016 won the league under Claudio Ranieri.
You're going a bit further back, Craig. You're going a bit further back.
Nathan, you're going to get the last word on this one. What do you make of what Craig's come back with there? What Ian's come back with.
I think Ian's making a good point, and it's a tricky one. But I would say that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer knows the success for Manchester United is winning leagues and winning titles. That's what I think it is. And whether or not he's going to be the person to do that, I'm not sure. But in some ways, I don't mind it because he's somebody who has that old style, Sir Alex Ferguson mentality. And that is what the club, I think, needed at some point. And if you do remove him, who do you bring in that's going to be able to sort of propel Manchester United to the point whereby they get as good as City have been in the last few years or as good as Liverpool have been? Because you look at their squad, you look at the team, and they're a good team. I'd say in this instance, I'd say City are number one, Chelsea are probably number two. Then I'd probably say Manchester United are the third best team right now. And I think their failings have come, in my opinion, in the last month or so. Because at one point, when they got to the top of the league, they looked a very good side, in my opinion. But City went on this run, and as a consequence, United haven't been able to match it. And some of that's been due to the fact that whereas City can beat a team 1-0 who's down at the bottom, who's struggling, and just find a way, United have fallen short against a side like Palace. But that's just that those games you expect United to win. So I think Ole's doing, I think he's changing the mentality. Maybe the players don't share his mentality just yet, but until he can bring in something that's better, I think he's a good fit for them in this instance.
I'm not going to ask predictions from everybody because I think I know the answer, but stick around because later on you can ask Ned and Ian and Shaka questions of your own coming up in Extra Time. You can always catch that over on YouTube.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Der Klassiker, a massive game that always delivers. Five goals in the reverse fixture. And look at this, Bayern Munich at the top of the table. And yes, Borussia Dortmund may be in fifth, but could they cause some problems for their eternal rival when it comes to their title chase and defending that title as well? We're delighted to now welcome in Archie Rintutt, our man in Germany. And what a big one we've got coming up. And it's bad news, Archie, at the moment for Borussia Dortmund, with more big names out.
Yeah, it was confirmed today, Kay, that Jadon Sancho, Rafael Guerrero and Gio Reyna all haven't made the trip to Munich, particularly for Borussia Dortmund against a Bayern Munich side which has had problems down that right-hand side defensively recently, and with the fact that they're not going to have a first-choice right-back available tomorrow. Niklas Süle is likely to play there again. It's a blow. But Dortmund have strength in other areas that will be fit tomorrow. Mo Dahoud, for example, has really shone in central midfield in recent weeks. Emre Can and Mats Hummels have formed a very resilient central defensive pairing. And I think resilience is the word that is applying to Dortmund more now than it was, say, a month ago when they were conceding seemingly every week from set pieces. And to get the win that they did get away at Borussia Mönchengladbach this week in the Cup, to take them into the semi-finals of that, that was a huge win for them. You just wonder, what will that take out of them in terms of energy, because Bayern have had a rare midweek off.
As for Bayern as well, obviously we know how strong they are and how stacked they are up top, but looking at their figures at the other end of the pitch, it's like almost 30 years since their defensive record has been so bad. Is that where Borussia Dortmund know that they could be there for the taking?
Yeah, it's a consequence of how attacking-minded that they are. This was the thing last season when they won the Champions League. There were still opportunities that their opponents had against them. I remember the game that they had against Lyon, for example, where on another night, Lyon could score first, and it's a different game. So this is a calculated risk that Bayern take, and Dortmund will get chances. Erling Haaland, who is, I think, the name on everybody's lips around the world right now in terms of the most up-and-coming talent, if you can even describe him in those terms, because he's so much better than so many other players right now. He has not always had the greatest time against Manuel Neuer in these games so far. He played in the Super Cup against him and scored once, but missed a one-on-one at 2-2, which would have taken Dortmund ahead. And in the game in the Bundesliga that we had in the reverse fixture, he scored one, but he missed chances before. And in his own words, when I spoke to him after that game, it was not good enough. So I think he will definitely see that he has some unfinished business here to try and take Dortmund to victory.
I wonder what one of the opposition players thinks about Erling Haaland. When we caught up with Joshua Kimmich earlier this week, we put some difficult questions to him. It was an either-or, and of course that big one was there, Mbappe or Haaland. This is what he had to say.
Schweinsteiger or Xabi Alonso?
Xabi Alonso.
Messi or Ronaldo?
Both.
Haaland or Mbappe?
Haaland.
Okay, game-winning assist or that chip goal versus Borussia Dortmund?
Yeah, chip goal against Dortmund.
Manuel Neuer or Oliver Kahn?
Manuel Neuer, of course.
Win the Euros or win the Champions League?
Winning the Euros.
right back or midfield?
Midfield.
Archie, if you were to guess here, who do you think is going to play more of a part in this game, Lewandowski or Haaland? You know I was going to give you a question like this.
History says Robert Lewandowski. In the last five home games for Bayern in the Bundesliga, last five editions of this fixture, he scored twice in each of them. And if he scores twice again tomorrow, then that will take him to 30 goals for the season, leaving him just 10 of the all-time record of Gerd Müller. So history says Robert Lewandowski, but Erling Haaland, as we've been saying, has a point to prove. And it's going to be a very good test of this, of how strong Borussia Dortmund's resurgence at the back has been. Nico Schulz, who came in and impressed away at Borussia Mönchengladbach during the week, who came to Borussia Dortmund for 20 million plus euros with a burgeoning reputation revived by Julian Nagelsmann at Hoffenheim. He is another that has a real point to prove in this game. And Dortmund just need to make sure that they don't do what they've done in their last three Bundesliga away games at Bayern, at least, which is collapse, because they lost 6-0, 5-0 and 4-0. So maybe 3-0 this time would be another improvement on that. But I think that they will at least score this time.
Would you care to make an actual prediction?
3-2 Bayern again.
Oh, repeat on this one. And obviously, it could all be very interesting with Leipzig playing before Bayern. But it's been great to hear from you, Archie. We'll be doing so again, as it's an historic day. This game will be live on ABC, a Bundesliga game for the first time live on ABC. And of course, you can also catch it on ESPN+. Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at electricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's lectricebikes.com. Football's laws surrounding handball are about to change. An IFAB statement here, as the interpretation of handball incidents was not always consistent due to incorrect applications of the law. The members confirmed that not every touch of a player's hand or arm with the ball is an offence, adding, accidental handball that leads to a teammate scoring a goal or having a goal-scoring opportunity will no longer be considered an offence. Now, the clarifications will come into force from July 1st. Glad to see these changes being made, Craig.
Actually, I am with the accidental handball, particularly when we've seen goals that have been disallowed and brought back by a ball that is ricocheted off an attacker's arm into a teammate's pathway through no fault of his own, 25, 30 yards from his goal. And VAR's gone back and micromanaged this. And looked at it and looked at it and looked at it. And you know, I'm glad to see, and we just seem to be doing this with all the laws now, where IFAB and all the cronies are having to go back and rewrite the words and try and reinvent the wheel here. But in the handball one, or the accidental handball, I am at least pleased that we're going to be going now to allow goals that have clipped an arm through no fault of a player's own, and where clearly they've not tried to gain an advantage. So I think, in my opinion, some common sense on this front.
Problem, though, Nedim, is that David Ellery, the IFAB technical director, has said that handball will always be a problem in the sense that it will always be subjective. So is this just making it a grey area all over?
Perhaps it is, yeah. But I think it's something which we're more used to, because I think when they got to a point where it felt extremely strict, people were feeling very, very disappointed, because you could see certain things which, as far as that subjectivity goes, would lean heavily towards the side of, well, he clearly didn't mean that. But, you know, in the same breath, the point that they make is a good one, because it is subjective. And, you know, from having played not that long ago, there were so many contentious decisions where somebody, like a referee, is telling you you've done something with intent, which you're like, well, no, I haven't. But he's got the final say on it. So hopefully there won't be too many issues where he's sort of caught in the grey area and it seems quite obvious. But I guess ultimately it's a positive sign because they've reviewed something, seen that it's not really working and gone to an older style system, which people are more used to. And as a consequence, I suppose you might get more of a sort of show of support from the people who make up the game, both on and off the field.
Ian, with this change, Josh Madger's goal would not have been disallowed against Spurs. Is this just what people want? That's obviously coming in next season. Do they just want more consistency in this area?
I think what people want is some common sense. I think VAR generally has become way too intrusive, like a nosy policeman going through with a fine-tooth comb on every single goal. That's not what it was invented for. It was invented for to stop major, and I'll underline that, major errors occurring. And we're getting some very silly ones like the Phil Jagielka red card the other night for Sheffield United. There was no need for VAR to get involved in that at all. It had been perfectly well handled by the referee. I think he got it right first time. Now, going back to the Fulham one, that's cost them a point last night because it was the correct decision as the law stands. But Mario Lemina has got his hand by his side. The ball is cannoned against it, rebounds off to Magyar, who equalises. The goal's disallowed because there was an accidental handball in the build-up to the goal. From July, the goal will have stood. That's too late for Fulham. They might go down for that point that they didn't get last night. So it's a crazy situation because that wouldn't have been handball by Lemina if he was standing in his own penalty area. No penalty would have been given because he hadn't changed his body shape or anything. You can't have laws where it's handball at one end of the pitch and not the other one. They've got themselves in a total mess, I'm afraid, with VAR. I was a big supporter of it, but it needs to be stripped down like an engine and completely rethought by FIFA.
And is that going to help referees Shaka and everybody else to understand the rule again?
Well, I think the law continues to evolve, and as interpretation and applications and how they're used and misused become evident. But to Ian's point there, this the Fulham incident is not a VAR issue. The Jagielka red card, that's down to the VAR. But the Fulham one, this is just about the law, how it was written and how it continues to be applied. And I was a part of the football advisory panel when we were redoing this handball law. And the feeling was you didn't want a hand to be involved in the scoring of a goal, whether inadvertently or not. And I think the key to this kind of rewriting of the law is accidental handball by a teammate. No one wants to see a goal scored with the arm, whether it's intentional or by accident. And you can look at the Llorente goal for Spurs a couple of years ago against City, Neymar in the Champions League final against Juventus a few years ago. Those are the ones that law was trying to address. I think it's key here that the difference or the update is that accidental handball by a teammate does not disallow the goal when it's eventually scored. It doesn't change the debate because I can already anticipate that there'll be an accidental handball that takes the ball out of the path of a defender who's getting ready to clear and into the path of a striker to score. While you know that is might be applauded now, if that happens to you or your team, you again have those same question marks, which is why, to David Ellery's point, this is handball will always be grey because it's subjective.
Well, let's bring the interpretation of the defensive handball in these clarifications. Handball should only be considered if the position of their arm is not a consequence of the player's body movement for that specific situation. By having their hand or arm in such a position, the player takes a risk of their hand or arm being hit by the ball and being penalised. So what do you make of that, Nadim?
Honestly, I hate the handball stuff. I absolutely detest it. Just because, so we have sort of buzzwords and talking points like unnatural and so on, but we never look at people's arms when there's no ball that's going towards it. The way that some people move, especially to be talking about defensive ones now, what is the benefit of a defender stopping a ball with his hand in an area where he's trying to defend? You know, like, so I'm... That sounded like so much jargon to me. But then to be putting that in the hands of a referee to make the call and say, well, yeah, you were in an unnatural position because you did this and you did that. it's nonsense, and it's the subjectivity which is going to really affect me and lots of other viewers here. And as sort of Shaka was alluding to as well, we have the law, we have the interpretation, but then we still have the emotion ourselves, where we can look at one thing and say, yeah, that's handball, and then look at it in the context of how it's affected a game and say that it's not handball. If something hits someone's hand and they're about to run through on goal, if someone hits the defender's hand and somebody's going to run through on goal, you want to feel like that's a handball because it stops someone running through on goal. But if there was no intention, then it shouldn't be handball. But then all of a sudden you've got a complete divide, and you're left with like the referee making a call, and it's going to upset half the people that are watching. So as I say, you've triggered me. I absolutely detest handballs. So I'm going to leave the mic and just say I'm glad that I'm retired.
Yeah, mic drop there, and that's where we will end this part of the show. But obviously you can see why it affects a team like Fulham, because obviously that goal would not be ruled out next season, Josh Madge's goal for Fulham that he scored against Spurs. And when you see where they are in the table, you can see just how annoying it is and how triggered Fulham fans will also be. Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply. Well, that is it from myself and Shaka. We'd like to thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, do not forget, Alessandro Del Piero will be with us tomorrow. So we'll be welcoming him with open arms. We'll see you then. Stay with us for extra time. Welcome into Extra Time, and don't worry, there are no handball questions or laws or clarifications or any of that, but let's get started with your questions. Dan the Orange Man would like to know, Nedim, what was it like to be playing for Man City in the midst of their big money takeover? When you first started playing at the club, did you ever believe they would reach the heights of today's team?
You know, for me personally, being an older style City fan, I'm more of a pessimist. So even though somebody came in and they said, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do whatever, in my mind, I'm still thinking like Venkies and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And things which didn't work out quite so well. But then all of a sudden, you start to see Robinho arrive. You start to see other players like that arrive. The coaching starts changing. The training ground starts changing. You start to think, well, this is it. This is a serious chance to try and do something. So even though as a player, you never knew what was coming next for you, it seemed like the club had changed its goals, changed its intent. And then in time, they started winning the big games. And as they started to win more and more of the big games, you start to realize that, yeah, this is for real. And I didn't think they'd be in a place where they've won 21 games in a row. But, you know, this was always the goal. Felt like the club was always designed to have a Pep Guardiola at the helm. They were always going to spend money, and now they're playing some of the best football that I think I've seen in my lifetime.
So, yeah, so maybe you can be more positive with future things like this when you see them, because obviously, a bit pessimistic at first, but it all turned out well in the end, right? OK, Ian, Kartik wants to know, why do big games fail to match their billing?
Well, they don't always fail to match their billing, but I know what it means at this point, because we have had a few 0-0 draws and we have had a few soporific games. I think, to be honest with you, there is a fair bit of burnout among the players. They didn't have a proper pre-season because of the pandemic and the rearrangement of last season, and I think you're starting to see that now. They're playing every 3 days. There's not so much time on the training ground. There isn't the rest and relaxation periods that there would be in a normal season. Everything's having to be condensed. So I think you are seeing a bit of tiredness in there as well. So I think that's partly to blame.
Nedim, would you like to weigh in on this one?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that as well, because I think there's a section here which doesn't get spoken about. But for some of these big games, you're seeing some of the best teams going up against each other, and they tend to be the best in attack and the best in defence. So a lot of the time, the matchups make it for a tighter game. I think if we saw these big games that finished 3-3s, 4-4s and a high scoring, you leave the game and you might be cooing about a team's attack, but you're asking huge questions about team's defenses. And without a solid defense, ultimately, you don't end up in the top sort of sections of a league. So the games for me are always going to be tight. But unfortunately, at the minute, people just aren't really taking their chances. And maybe that is to Ian's point about tiredness and so on. But as I say, the matchups aren't geared towards having high scoring games, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think that's the thing here. So there aren't many teams who just throw caution to the wind, throw all caution to the wind from beginning to end.
Well, maybe outside regardless. Of the Premier League.
Well, but my point is, so often you see teams, even attack-minded teams, they take the lead, they get the first goal, and then their reaction is to defend that lead. So they don't want to give anything in return. And then more times than not, because the first goal becomes so important, you have two teams who may be otherwise attack-minded become more aware, more cautious about conceding that first goal. And then that first goal never comes. And we're here having these same conversations about two attacking teams otherwise, you know, okay. And that's the frustration.
True. Bayern, Dortmund coming up this weekend, 3-2 last time they faced off.
Are you predicting a lot of goals?
I'm predicting a lot of goals in that.
You want to tell everybody about mine and your bet around Bundesliga and those two teams?
I absolutely walked into a bet with Xhaka that I didn't even have to take, that he said Lewandowski will outscore Haaland this season. And we know how that's going.
I was just sitting there quietly, minding my own business, and you come steaming in with this bet.
It's still time to turn it around.
Okay, all right.
It's still time.
Okay.
Speaking of entertaining players.
It's a good bet.
It was a terrible bet on my part, Ian. Speaking of entertaining players, though, Ian, Frank McManaman would like to know, who is the most entertaining player that you've ever commentated on?
I think I'd have to go, short answer, Lionel Messi. He's just phenomenal. It's a privilege to be watching a player that good. Some of the things he does is, well, they're just out of this world. So our privilege and pleasure to cover him. Messi.
Nedim, just turning that around a bit, what about the most entertaining player that you've played alongside?
I think that's a good question. You probably would have been someone like an Aguero or somebody, maybe like... I actually quite enjoyed playing with Carlos Tevez just for a little bit because he was high energy, he was for the team, and he was very, very clinical as well. And to see the way that he worked, it kind of set the tone for the rest of the team. And at the time, we weren't this type of city, but that old-style city, he really was a talisman within that. So he was definitely entertaining, and he always stepped up and scored as well.
Okay. Xhaka, if Tottenham finish outside the top six, should Jose be fired? And if so, what would be a reasonable next coaching job for him?
I don't know. I haven't been a fan of Jose Mourinho. I didn't think it was a good fit him going to Spurs, just kind of given their own history and what their fan base expects. I just find some of his football so negative. And you look at Jose Mourinho and the expectation, given his record, which he earned, and you know, you cannot try to discredit, is he's only going to manage at big clubs. And what big club wants to play the kind of football that you've seen from Spurs for a lot of the season? I just don't think there's that club out there, other than Atletico Madrid, who are doing that under Diego Simeone. And is that Jose Mourinho's only possible next destination on the face of what you see right now? Quite possibly.
Okay. Tim would like to know, Nedim, what was it like to play in the famous Man City QPR match in May 2012, having joined QPR from City just months earlier?
Well, to be honest, from my side, it was a nightmare. It really, really was. I don't remember what score the game was, but I'm pretty sure in the build-up to it, as I got to the stadium, I knew everybody, from the people who were at the car park, to the people giving you tickets, to the people saying hello in the tunnel and all this stuff. But the only problem was, instead of turning left to the City dressing room, I was turning right to go to the QPR one with a bunch of players in the team who I'd known for probably 3 months, going out there knowing that we need to get a result to try and guarantee our place in the Premier League. It was so, so surreal because, again, as I say, I've been at City from the age of 10 and now I've just left a few months earlier. And as you go out there, you're feeling a bit of tension in the air. City obviously have their moment. They scored the first goal. But there was a 20-minute window where I think after we took the lead, City were as bad as I think they were in the whole season. And that section gets kind of pushed to the side because of how it ended. But being a player for QPR in that moment, thinking we're going to stay up by beating City, that was both exciting and a bit nerve-wracking because of the fact that I was from Manchester and I was going home to Manchester after the game as a City fan. But to be fair, I got lucky, and the way the game ended, I'll be honest, I didn't know who scored the winning goal for City for days afterwards, because when the goal went in, I thought we were down and I was crushed. But upon getting more stable and being in a stadium where our QPR fans are celebrating, the City fans are celebrating, every player on the pitch was celebrating. If there was another 10 minutes to go in that game, I guarantee you someone would have rolled the ball in the centre circle and the players would have just danced around it. So it ended up being an incredible day for me, incredible day for City, incredible day for QPR.
Wow, what a brilliant story, though. Just how lost you can get in a game to not know who one of the scorers was, as well as the player yourself. Great question as well, Tim. David wants to know, Ian Dark, other than boxing, which is an international sport, have you called any American sports? And if so, which American sport is your favourite?
No, I haven't called any American sports, and you wouldn't want to hear me trying either. I'd be absolutely hopeless. I think I'd last about 5 seconds. They've got lots and lots of wonderful commentators there who are way more qualified than me to call NFL and so on. So I suppose boxing is a kind of an American sport as well. But I've called plenty of boxing matches in my time. I love Nedham's story there, by the way. I was at that game commentating for ESPN, going out the Premier League on ESPN in those days. And I'm just thinking, Nedham, yes. If Joey Barton hadn't got sent off, history could have been very different, couldn't it, that day?
To be honest, we don't speak his name.
But it looks like you're an American football fan there, Nedham.
College football, yeah, from my time in Utah, yeah. Go Utes, all that good stuff.
Nice.
There we go.
So maybe there's another role there as well, a bit of commentary work. American football for Nedham. Shaka, how did you manage to get to NASA intern and pro football at the same time?
Well, it wasn't at the same time. It was a couple of years in between. So I just as a junior at college in DC and just applying for some internships. And a recruitment agency contacted me about the NASA position, and there I was. Some of my junior years, so that would have been 1991, did an internship for NASA. Their headquarters were in DC, right downtown DC. And then the following year, I got picked up by the Baltimore Blast indoor team. And they were touring England. They played 2 games against Aston Villa. Dwight had just joined Villa. I definitely got man in match in at least one, if not both. And a Reading scout saw me playing in that game. The rest, as they say, is history.
Did you ever wonder if there had been a sliding doors moment and it had turned out differently?
No, Kay. I do not. I don't.
You're quite happy with Reading.
I'm very happy. When I joined Reading, I still used to go into Reading University and do engineering classes, just in case. Because you never know, right? You never know how this career is going to pan out. I'm new in football. And I signed for Reading, you know, making £400 a week or something like that. And I still used to go and take some engineering classes at Reading University, just in case. So there was no sliding door moment.
Ah, it sounds like you were a bit pessimistic as well.
Well,
about the future.
You've got to keep those sliding doors open, Kay, is what it is. Just in case.
Well, in the film, does she or doesn't she? That's okay, how it goes. Right. Anyway, big name joining our illustrious panel tomorrow. We're delighted to have Alessandro Del Piero with us. He will be part of the ESPN FC team and talking about his former club, Juventus. Make sure you catch ESPN FC daily on ESPN Plus. Thanks to all the guys for being with us for the latest edition.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.